The following program is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, and it is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. And that program is The Independent, the Indie Week. And I'm John Feddersen, as I come most weeks, and I'll read this week's issue to you. The date of said issue, September the 18th of 2025. All right, folks, and here we go with our first article from the town of Zebulon and its mayoral race, which is taking shape amid town turmoil. Zebulon's next mayor will preside over an era of explosive growth for the tiny East Wake County town, and all of the housing, development, infrastructure, and budgeting concerns that come along with it. They'll also be expected to help stabilize a town hall that's weathered a series of challenges and controversies over the past year, including a high rate of staff turnover, a lawsuit over a rejected development proposal, a commissioner's resignation, and an as-yet unsuccessful effort to replace her, and public calls for the Board of Commissioners to be reconstituted. In the five-way race for Zebulon mayor, the candidates subscribe to one of two schools of thought. Incumbent Mayor Glenn York and sitting Commissioners Shannon Baxter and Jessica Harrison say the town is basically on the right track, barring a few stumbles, and that they have the experience and relationships to keep it that way. In the second camp, former Commissioner Larry Lukes and former town manager Gilbert Todd says Zebulon's current board is ineffective, and they are trying to make this election about the transparency and accountability they think it lacks. These conflicting perspectives were on display during Tuesday's mayoral candidate forum hosted by the Zebulon Chamber of Commerce, which drew an audience of about 100 people. Here are a few takeaways from that forum. Is the current board doing a good job? Depends whom you ask. Baxter, who's been a commissioner since 2019, says, "We have so much to be proud of here." Her current term ends in 2027. "We are headed in the right direction. Our town is fiscally sound. We make fantastic decisions for our community every time we meet." She cited Zebulon's town services, road improvements, garbage collection, and planning and zoning as evidence that local government is chugging along as it should. And York, in a similar vein, said, "I would just like the opportunity to continue what is already in place." Yet, some town residents, including 400 who signed a petition earlier this year calling for the current board's removal, aren't happy with what's already in place. They feel like the commissioners are hard to reach and not accountable to their community. Todd, who resigned from the town manager role earlier this year after he alleges the board asked him to place a colleague on administrative leave without cause, and he said, "I am the only candidate in this race who has never held elected office. The other candidates have had their chance to represent you, and many of you have expressed deep dissatisfaction with the results, the chaos, indecision, and lack of transparency. I'm offering you a fresh start. When I become mayor, you will never have to guess what my thoughts are," he said. Similarly, Lauchs, a commissioner from 2019 to 23, and the chairman of Zebulon's Board of Adjustments for 20 years before that, told the audience he's committed to being accessible to the public in person, by email, and by phone. Quote, "I will be just as accessible after the campaign. I will try to look out for you and take care of you and actually warn you what I see coming down the pike." By the way, Lukes and Todd are the only candidates who have responded to Indy's interview requests. In the past 2 years, Zebulun has seen turnover in the positions of town manager, town clerk, police chief, planning director, communications director, and public works director. That's 6 out of 11 positions on the town management team, plus an assistant town manager who resigned and was never replaced. Although the candidates' conversation didn't cover why this is or how it's affected the town's operations, all of them hinted at the turnover in their remarks, emphasizing the need to pay staff competitively and hire a permanent town manager and police chief as soon as possible. Both jobs are currently filled by interim hires. Next chapter, Zebulun's mayor votes only in the case of a tie, so they have to exercise their power in other ways. As with most local candidate forums, Tuesday's event was not so much a debate as an opportunity for the mayoral hopefuls to take turns talking about themselves and their priorities. One rare moment of back and forth came when Lokes suggested that as mayor, he would try to meet individually with the commissioners ahead of public board meetings to make sure he knew where they stood and the board was prepared to deliberate. He said, "I would ask a fellow commissioner, have you done your homework?" He explained the mayor is allowed to meet with up to 2 commissioners at a time before it counts as a quorum and must be publicized. Baxter disagreed. "I don't think having meetings outside of regular meetings is the way to go," she replied. "Really, a mayor's job, besides running the meeting, is to represent Zebulun in the best way possible." York said the mayor's main job is to build consensus, acknowledging that, quote, "with 5 different opinions and ideas, that is a challenge. I'll never say that the commissioners are making bad decisions. They've just been not making the best decision at that time," end quote. Next, the candidates tried to differentiate themselves with mixed success, with York, Baxter, and Harrison all running on a pitch to essentially stay the course. Tuesday's forum offered them an opportunity to get a bit more specific. Harrison emphasized her relationships with county and state-level leaders and her commitment to youth and senior services. Quote, she said, "I have spoken many times with the county commissioners, and I believe we are getting closer to having them work with us to create senior centers and youth centers," she said. Baxter spoke about existing economic development initiatives like Zebulun's small business grants and its participation in that North Carolina Main Street program. York, although he is the incumbent, mentioned a few places where he thinks the town is falling short, including paying staff competitively and working collaboratively as a board. He also reminded the audience that his opponent's campaign promises may be expensive to execute. Quote, "I think as citizens we depend on municipal government too much. We as a municipality cannot answer this wish list because any time you come up with something, there's a price tag. And if there's a price tag, there's a tax increase." Luke's focused on budget and taxes, pointing out Zebulun's budget is growing and its tax rate is the highest in Wake County. "One of the things I do as mayor is forensic accounting," he said. "At the end of the year, I'd actually show you how we spent your money." Todd doubled down on the importance of restoring public trust and empowering town staff to do their best work. Finally, turnout for Zebulun's local elections has historically been very low. In 2021, with a total population of about 8,000 residents, 558 people voted for mayor there, which was an improvement from 199 in 2017. Early voting in this year's plurality election begins on October the 16th, and election day is November 4. Next, a couple of articles from Durham. First, the candidates distanced themselves from Yes for Durham, following a report in Indy. In the 2 days since Indy published its investigation into Yes for Durham, which is a new 501c4 nonprofit with undisclosed leadership and connections to one of its endorsed candidates, all four of the municipal candidates endorsed by the group have publicly disavowed it on social media. Statements from Leonardo Williams, Mark Anthony Middleton, Matt Kopeck, and Diana Midoff all assert the candidates have not coordinated with Yes for Durham and will not accept its money. Williams, Kopeck, and Midoff included in their statements they don't want support from 501c4s, which can also make independent expenditures supporting candidates like sending mailers or running ads in general. In a text to the Indy, Middleton also said he opposes such support, stating, "Dark money has no place in Durham's local politics, and all candidates should commit to that." Yes for Durham, endorsement status notwithstanding. Midoff, the Ward 3 candidate, whose husband's property served as Yes for Durham's original registered address before it was amended, posted a statement titled, "A Commitment to Transparency," to Instagram soon after the Indy's initial story was published. The statement acknowledged that her husband's, quote, "initial ties to the organization have created reasonable concerns regarding the funding of my campaign." Midoff wrote, "I did not seek this endorsement. I have not, nor will I, accept any money for Yes for Durham or any other 501c4 organizations." She urged all organizations to endorse her campaign only through official political action committees and called on Yes for Durham to release the names of its leadership, quote, "with a sense of urgency." Midoff told the Indy before the initial story she had, quote, "absolutely no involvement with Yes for Durham," and while her husband initially got involved when community members approached him, he removed himself completely from the organization before the organization decided to make endorsements. Mayor Pro Tem Middleton, Ward 2 incumbent running for re-election, posted a statement to Facebook within an hour of Indy's initial story. "Middleton for Durham did not seek this endorsement," he wrote. "Middleton for Durham has not received any money from this group. Middleton for Durham will not accept any money from this group." He continued, quote, "There are lots of groups that have popped up all in our city lately that are endorsing candidates and spending money to influence our local election, and all candidates should take the opportunity to clarify where things of value to their campaigns are coming from." Middleton had told the Indy before the initial story he had, quote, "absolutely no coordination with Yes for Durham." Kopeck, who's running in Ward 1, posted a statement to Instagram the evening of Indy's initial report. Quote, "In response to recent reporting by the Indy," Kopeck wrote, he wanted to make clear he has, quote, "not coordinated with Yes for Durham, did not seek this endorsement, has not been offered financial or other support, and will not be accepting contributions from it." Writing, "Integrity and trust mean everything in this process. Transparency into groups seeking to influence our election is critical, and I want to make it clear that I do not want any contributions or support from 501c4 organizations in this race." The Indy left Kopeck a voicemail requesting comment 24 hours before publishing its initial story on Saturday. After publication, Kopeck quickly followed up to provide comment, saying he had received a notification of endorsement and an invitation to a mixer from Yes for Durham, quote, "but other than that, I had no contact," and also said he had not received the Indy's voicemail. Mayor Williams, who told Indy before the initial story that he received an emailed notification of his endorsement, but doesn't know who's involved with Yes for Durham, posted a statement to social media today that referred to Yes for Durham as a, quote, dark money group, writing, I categorically denounce all groups that would attempt to buy an election in Durham, despite public statements that seem to suggest these groups would be progressively aligned. I firmly believe that any politically oriented group, like the new Durham Black PAC or Yes for Durham, should disclose their leadership, roster, donors, and spending activities. Williams added that his campaign, quote, has not, does not, and will not accept support from such groups, and will continue to only acknowledge groups that disclose their internal operations and participants. Yes for Durham was incorporated as this 501c4 on August 18th and published endorsements on September 3rd. The organization told Indy in an unsigned email it was, quote, founded by a group of Durham citizens who closely follow local politics, and they will disclose its leadership, quote, when the board is fully comprised. The group's website features a donation portal alongside text that reads, quote, with Election Day on November 4th, your support turns hopeful vision into concrete results. Chip in today. As a 501c4, Yes for Durham can engage in political activity, but not as its primary purpose. Former Democracy North Carolina Executive Director Bob Hall told Indy that the organization's quick formation and endorsements raise questions about whether electoral activity is its primary purpose. Yes for Durham told Indy, quote, it will not engage in activity that requires registration as a political committee, and that its mission is, quote, to elevate conversation around its policy agenda in current and future election cycles. If Yes for Durham makes independent expenditures exceeding $100 to promote candidates, it would be required to report that spending to the State Board of Elections within 30 days or 10 days before the election, whichever comes first. If Yes for Durham raises funds for general 501c4 activities, it can list itself as the sole source when reporting expenditures, keeping its donors anonymous. At this point, it's not clear if Yes for Durham has raised any money. Early voting for Durham's municipal primary begins today, September the 18th. Well, next we move over to Orange County and an article that says Orange County elections just got less competitive. John Mitchell and Linnie Agrabright have withdrawn from the Chapel Hill Town Council and Chapel Hill Carborough City School Board's elections, respectively. This pair of withdrawals turns this already sleepy Orange County election cycle into a bit of a municipal snooze fest. Five candidates are campaigning for four town council seats, and just three candidates are seeking three school board seats. Mitchell said in an email to Indy, I'm deeply grateful for the encouragement I received, but after weighing both the competitive dynamic of the race, five other highly electable candidates, and what I could realistically accomplish if elected, less than I'd like, I decided the opportunity cost of missing essentially 2 months of family life was too high. I applaud the other candidates for their willingness to serve and wish them well. I'll continue my work on the Planning Commission as a board member of Shift Chapel Hill Carborough and through my Substack newsletters. Agrabright could not be reached for comment, but voiced similar sentiments about the high demands of a campaign at the candidate forum last month that she attended as a spectator. The news means that the CHCS board will not see any major shakeups. Incumbents George Griffin and Risa Jenkins will hold their seats for 4 more years, while Melinda Manning will take that seat left vacant by Michael Sharp, who declined to run again. Manning, noting the recent budget difficulties at CHCCS, is running on a platform of, quote, radical transparency, as the board tries to maintain the district's shining reputation despite local, state, and federal budget troubles. The pair of withdrawals leave Chapel Hill's town council election as the only truly competitive race in Orange County, and it's still less than a barn burner. Of the 4 seats up for grabs, 2 are currently held by incumbents Camille Berry and Paris Miller-Fouché, who will both enjoy some name recognition advantage over challengers Wes McMahon, Louis Rivers III, and Eric Valera. No matter who wins, the council of the progressive town is going to have to continue to figure out how to do more with less, as costs continue to rise and federal government becomes less interested in helping people. Mayor Jess Anderson told Indy this summer, after a particularly contentious budget vote, "Social service needs and the needs for folks who are struggling are just going to go up. We're left holding the bag." Anderson is running unopposed for another 2-year term as the pirate portrayer, motivated to run by a town bus crash, made noises about challenging Anderson, but never filed. The pirate portrayer. Apparently there's an article about that, which is not provided here in this print. In Carrboro, Mayor Barbara Fouché is facing only one challenger, Joe H. Lloyd, Jr., who is a registered Republican, bravely seeking election in a town where Harris won as much as 85% of the vote in some neighborhoods. And the 3 seats for Carrboro Town Council attracted, you guessed it, 3 candidates. The low number of candidates seems a bit incongruous for the highly educated, generally well-engaged towns of Orange County. Everyone on Reddit apparently has an opinion about how to improve towns and schools, but few, it seems, have the time, money, or energy to run for office. Early voting in this election begins October the 16th. Next, over to APEX. APEX establishes a town-sponsored community land trust. At its regular town council meeting this week, APEX leaders voted unanimously to establish a community land trust, a CLT, for affordable housing. Under the CLT model, land owned by the town can be held in the trust in perpetuity, and affordable housing built on it and sold to residents at affordable rates with a guaranteed 99-year lease on the land. When an owner is ready to sell, they can work with CLT to set a new sale price for the home, having gained some equity based on the appreciated value of the home. Marla Newman, APEX's Director of Community Development and Neighborhood Connections, told the council at his meeting on September the 9th, "As we know here, land is one of the more expensive aspects of development costs that we're facing, which undercuts our ability to offer more affordable homes. So, if the CLT maintains the land, but leases it at a favorable price, that helps promote affordability, and that buyer or renter is only paying for the structure." The town of APEX will now work to incorporate the CLT as a nonprofit, and council members will appoint a board of directors to eventually be composed equally members of CLT households, residents from the surrounding APEX community, and, quote, public interest members, including public officials, funders, or representatives from local social services or housing nonprofits. Once the town has its first board of directors appointed, the board will launch an initial land development program. It will issue requests for proposals, RFP, requests for proposals, for an independent management entity and development partners. Once identified, those partners will work with that board to prepare development agreements, ground leases, and grant and loan agreements, and they will prepare covenants declaring affordability somewhere between 60 and 80% of the area median income. A home at a market rate price of $459,000, for instance, would cost $359,000 in the CLT model, Newman explained, as the town would be covering $100,000 for the cost of the land. The town of Apex has been considering establishing a CLT since 2021. Attorney Stephen Carr, who is working with the town, noted at this meeting. The town updated its affordable housing plan earlier this year after it purchased approximately 13 acres of land on South Hughes Street near the Stone Glen Apartments development to help with its goal of creating more affordable options. Town staff recommended that the creation of a CLT to facilitate long-term affordability of the homes that will be built on the site, as well as any other properties the town may utilize for housing purposes, according to a town staff memo. Following the council's approval, the town staff will now work with attorneys to create this nonprofit by November of this year, according to a slide presentation Newman gave to the council at Tuesday's meeting. The council will appoint and seat a board of directors by February of next year, develop governance documents by May, and send out an RFP, request for proposals, in June. While there are more than 300 CLTs across the nation, including several here in the Triangle, including Raleigh-Durham and Chapel Hill, Apex's model looks to be somewhat unique in that it is town-sponsored and uses town-owned land. Across the country, Apex town staff identified government-led CLT models in Carver County, Minnesota, the city of Flagstaff, Arizona, Harris County, Texas, and Chicago. Newman said some of them have staff internal to their organization that manage the land trust. Some contract with third parties. Of course, our position would be, rather than trying to build that capacity in-house, it would make more sense to look for a third party that has experience and a track record to actually partner with us in terms of managing the land trust. The CLT model is not new to Apex entirely. In recent months, the nonprofit Raleigh Area Land Trust, RALT, partnered with a private developer, Pulte Homes, on building a mix of affordable rental and for-sale townhomes in the new Prestwick and Huxley communities. The developer had promised to include the affordable units to the town as a rezoning condition. Going forward, Newman said, any land the town purchases for housing could be added to this trust. Apex Town Council member Audra Killingsworth, before making the motion to approve the CLT, said, I'm sad I'm not going to be in the weeds on this as we come up next year. Killingsworth's term on the council ends this year, and she's not running for re-election. But, she added, I'm super excited. This is moving forward. And electoral news, so to speak, in a way, from Durham. Durham Rising is pushing council candidates to turn the heat up on Duke University. Durham labor groups looking to improve wages, housing affordability, and workers' rights have set their sights on Duke University, the city's largest employer and private landowner. With local elections getting underway, organizers have found willing partners in the menagerie of Durham Council candidates all of whom seemed to agree that Duke University should do better by the people of Durham. Organizers are trying to tap into election season and anti-corporate, anti-billionaire, and not infrequent anti-Duke sentiment to push the university to put its $12 billion endowment toward its workers and the community. Last year, the Duke Respects Durham campaign called for Duke to make a $50 million annual direct payments to the city, referred to as payment in lieu of taxes, or PILOT. A recent forum organized by a similar local campaign, Durham Rising, focused on getting candidates for council and mayor to get Duke, per signs at that event, to show up for Durham. Quote, asked one questioner, Duke owns property all across Durham, but unlike the rest of us, it's exempt from paying property taxes on most of it. Other universities have agreed to a payment in lieu of taxes program, which is also called a pilot. Do you believe Duke owes it to the community to contribute to the public school system by implementing a similar pilot program? Asked one questioner. Do you agree that Duke should stand up to protect workers, student, faculty, programs, and our communities from attacks by the federal government? Asked another. Representatives for Duke have previously argued the university contributes $24 million to the community annually. That includes more than $2 million the university pays in taxes for its non-academic buildings it owns, $7 million in taxes connected to the 2.8 million square feet of space the school leases, $4 million in direct payments for emergency services in Durham, and another $10 million it gives to local nonprofits. Duke administrators have not commented publicly on Durham Rising. The forum was something of a tug of war between incumbents who tried to point out the council's ongoing efforts to get more money out of the university and challengers, many of whom advocated for more to be done. Mark Anthony Middleton, seeking to hold his Ward 2 seat, pointed out he had previously pushed for using eminent domain to take Duke's land to build a light rail system. And he said, I learned some things during that process about negotiation, about our legal guardrails, and about how to treat people. So I'm glad we're all talking about getting tough with Duke. Welcome to the party. Middleton is often notes that Duke contributed to 70 units of affordable housing on Willard Street next to the downtown bus station. Just last month, the smiling Duke President Vincent Price helped cut the ribbon at the Ashton Place residence for low-income residents 55 and older, which the university also helped fund. Middleton is fond of adapting a Chris Rock quote, it's like your uncle who molested you but paid for you to go to college, he often says, to describe the relationship between the city and the university. Some challengers pitched the more dramatic ideas from collecting for the university. Terry McCann, candidate for mayor, suggested the city stop providing waste and police services to the university. Think about it, he said. The students who go to Duke, their parents are going to complain. They're going to force their little youngins there to report it to the administration. Durant Long, seeking to usurp Chelsea Cook from her Ward 3 seat, said Duke and Durham have a, quote, parasitic relationship, and called on Duke employees to strike. Quote, while Duke has profited from the backs of Durhamites, they've gained their endowment. They've disenfranchised us. They've pushed us out. They haven't contributed in any meaningful way. At the end of the forum, nearly all the candidates present, Mayor Leo Williams, who is seeking re-election, did not attend, signed a petition with Durham Rising's core demands that Duke raise its minimum wage to $25 an hour, make direct payments to City of Durham to support public schools, address the need for affordable housing and pay city workers, and do a better job of protecting its workers and students from the federal government and ICE. McCann, a Republican who was jeered by the crowd for his approval of Trump's immigration policies, declined to sign on. As some candidates noted, a lot has changed since the blue and yellow Duke Respect Durham signs first hit lawns a year ago. Duke announced in April it would be cutting 10%, or about $350 million, from its budget as the Trump administration slashed research funding and threatened other cuts. Officials said that target was based on projections that the federal funding cuts and policy changes, including tiered tax rates on college endowments, could result in losses totaling as much as $500 to $750 million. The university offered voluntary buyouts, which some 600 employees accepted, and has continued to lay off staff, leaving some departments scrambling. Samaria McKenzie, a marketing specialist hoping to grab Deidreana Freeman's Ward 1 seat, says Duke is set to lose up to the tune of $200 million in federal funding. So I can sit up here and I can tell you all the things that get the crowd going, but that just is not actually going to do anything, except for its power to accept or reject rezoning requests. The city has few official and lawful avenues to make demands of Duke. Last year, the university petitioned the council to approve an open-ended rezoning for several chunks of campus, including parcels that Duke owns in the Birch Avenue neighborhood. Residents and council members were skeptical when Duke declined to comment to not building a parking garage or bus depot inside the quiet neighborhood, and Duke eventually withdrew that portion of the request. Early voting begins this week ahead of the October 7th primary election, and from there, two candidates in each race will proceed to the general elections on November the 3rd. Next, from Wake Forest. Wake Forest mayor walks back Pride Month proclamation. Wake Forest residents have recently started celebrating Pride Month in their town in October, and at a town board of commissioners work session earlier this month, Mayor Vivian Jones looked poised to support their efforts. Quote, "We're going to have a proclamation proclaiming October as Pride Month in Wake Forest," she said toward the end of the 45-minute long meeting on September the 2nd, during the commissioner's reports portion. "The proclamation, one you just mentioned, is not one that I would be supportive of," said Commissioner Faith Cross when it was her turn to speak. No one else addressed that proclamation, and the meeting went into closed session. Then, in a social media post a week later, Jones said she had mixed up Pride Month, which traditionally happens in June, with LGBTQ History Month, which is observed in October in cities and towns throughout the United States, Jones wrote. But she added, she came to the decision that Wake Forest will not recognize LGBTQ History Month at all. She wrote in a September 9th post on Facebook, "I apologize for confusing the two observances, but more importantly, I am terribly sorry for the discord it has generated in our community." Jones said since the September 2nd meeting, she's heard from several people in the community, quote, "expressing strong feelings on both sides of the issue." She explained her willingness to recognize Pride Month was motivated by a commitment to the town's strategic plan goal, quote, "fostering a safe, diverse, and welcoming community." She wrote, "I now realize that by expressing support for our LGBTQ community, I may have unintentionally suggested the town's official support for one set of deeply held beliefs over another set, just as deeply rooted. Therefore, after careful consideration, and as an acknowledgement of the diversity of convictions throughout our community, I have decided not to proceed with issuing any proclamation related to LGBTQ History Month. Jones did not immediately respond to Indy's request for further comment, but we will update the story when we hear back. Now, in October 2021, Wake Forest adopted this non-discrimination policy that protects residents from discrimination, including on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And in June of 2024, it signed on to Wake County's non-discrimination ordinance, which provides explicit protections for the LGBTQ community, joining Raleigh, Cary, Garner, Knightdale, Morrisville, Wendell, and Apex. Last year, the nonprofit Wake Forest Pride, which works to create safe spaces and promote equality in the town, hosted its first Pride event in downtown Wake Forest. The nonprofit addressed Jones' decision in a social media post of its own. The group says it plans to host its second festival, celebrating Pride in Wake Forest on October 11th, which is National Coming Out Day. The post states, "Every human being deserves to live authentically. Every person deserves to be welcomed fully into their community, and every voice, especially those too often pushed aside, deserves to be heard." Jones has served as mayor of Wake Forest since 2001 and is up for re-election this year. Wake Forest Commissioner Ben Clapsaddle is challenging Jones in the municipal election this fall for the town's top seat. The race is officially nonpartisan, but Clapsaddle is registered Democrat while Jones is unaffiliated. Clapsaddle was absent from last week's work session, but says when he reviewed the video of the meeting, he was happy Jones decided to make the proclamation publicly and, quote, "very disappointed when she decided to rescind it, especially without having spoken to other commissioners first and giving them a chance to weigh in." He said, "It's a shame. I think it's a disservice to all our citizens, not just the LGBTQ community alone, but all of us, if we truly believe, and I do, that we're a welcoming and diverse community, and that we respect everybody and treat everybody with dignity and honor. I don't understand why you would back out from some political pressure. I'm very sad for that part. We as a community are better than that." Nearly 1,000 comments came in response to Jones' Facebook post, and it has so far been shared by more than 100 times. Comments conveyed a mix of viewpoints, but most expressed disappointment in the decision. So the lesson here is that intolerance, ignorance, and divisiveness is okay as long as it's coming from the dominant white straight Christian culture, wrote Facebook user Ricky Schmatters Gee. Thank you, Mayor, for clarifying that. "As a new resident of Wake Forest, this is very disheartening," wrote Facebook user Amy Lynn. "I would have been proud to live in a town that officially recognizes and celebrates LGBTQ history, but it seems like maybe Wake Forest is the type of place that capitulates to homophobia. Really cool. Not welcoming." Really uncool, excuse me. Well, last on the, the solid civics-related stories in Indy Week this week, Raleigh's former solid waste services director is suing the city for alleged retaliation and ADA violations. Stan Joseph's lawsuit, which has not previously been reported, coincides with complaints from current SWS employees that point to ongoing issues in the department, solid waste services. One driver spoke publicly about safety concerns on the job earlier this summer, and Indy spoke to several more who agree there are safety and management problems under SWS new leadership. Jones served as director of SWS from July 2018 until he was put on administrative leave in July of 2024 and subsequently fired in November. In his lawsuit, which he filed last summer and has continued to update as recently as last week, Joseph says he complained to his supervisor about the city's, quote, dysfunctional human resources department several times in 2020 and 21, flagging specific areas of policy, practice, compliance, and law violations in the HR department, quote, that were concerning and negatively impacting employees. Joseph claims he brought his concerns to an assistant city manager, the HR director, the assistant to the city manager, and city manager Marshall Adams David, and they did not take action. The city, in its answer to Joseph's lawsuit, denies that he ever lodged those complaints. According to the city, Joseph and Adams David spoke once about how Joseph indicated he disagreed with the requirements of some HR policies and with some staff. Indy asked Joseph and the city of Raleigh if they could elaborate on the alleged problems in HR that Joseph alluded to in the lawsuit. The city declined to comment because the suit is ongoing. Joseph wrote in an email, quote, "My concerns were about policies and practices that directly impacted employees, law, and the department's ability to operate effectively." The suit goes on to describe what Joseph considers to be a pattern of retaliation against him. First, he says, the city launched an investigation into his use of profanity with the staff members. Joseph and the city's characterization of this investigation are very different. He maintains that it was bogus, the only instance to his knowledge when the city had investigated a department head for using profanity. The city of Raleigh, on the other hand, wrote in its response to the suit, it launched the investigation in response to a complaint from a subordinate of Joseph's who, quote, alleged he felt targeted and was subjected to hostile work environment and that Joseph's behavior toward him was unprofessional. The investigation ended with Joseph receiving a written warning in January of 2022. Joseph's email to the Indy said, that situation came during a period of tremendous stress. Like anyone, I'm human, and I made a mistake in expressing frustration. In my years of leadership, professionalism and accountability were always priority. To my knowledge, no one else had ever been subjected to a formal investigation for a similar slip, which is why I believe the investigation into that moment was disproportionate and retaliatory. He maintains in the lawsuit that he received exceptional performance reviews up till that investigation. The city contests this, but acknowledges that his direct supervisor congratulated him for improving morale in the SWS department in 2020, and Adams David told him he was, quote, a well-regarded member of the management team in 2022. Joseph writes in his suit, the investigation and warning exacerbated his PTSD symptoms. He has PTSD as a result of several combat deployments with the U.S. Air Force. He writes he experienced migraines, acute chest pains, and panic attacks, and that he requested disability accommodations for the heightened symptoms in February of 22. Joseph claims the city did not approve his accommodations promptly, but the city denies this. Joseph also claims that throughout his employment with the city, Adams David, quote, verbally denigrated individuals with PTSD. He claims Adams David called people with PTSD crazies and low energy, and specifically called Joseph low energy during a meeting with him and his team. Joseph and his lawyers maintain this is an ADA violation. The city forcefully denies all this, including Adams David's alleged comments. Its answer to the lawsuit says it is specifically denied that Adams David referred to individuals diagnosed with PTSD as crazies or any other disparaging term. Adams David didn't respond to a request for comment. A city spokesperson reiterated the city had no comment on pending litigation and noted that the city manager is not a party to the pending legal action. At one point in its response to the lawsuit, lawyers for the city questioned the relevance of the ADA to Joseph's complaint, writing, quote, upon information and belief, Joseph is not a qualified individual with a disability within the meaning of the Americans with Disability Act. Joseph details in his complaint how he was placed on administrative leave and eventually fired, which he considers to be further retaliation for his complaints about the HR department. He is seeking attorney's fees and punitive damages from the city of Raleigh and has asked for a jury trial, which has not been scheduled. The most current version of his lawsuit notes he has been unable to find work since he was fired. He wrote to Indy he decided to bring the suit for, quote, accountability and fairness. I raised concerns because I believed employees and residents deserved transparency, safety, and respect. Unfortunately, the response I experienced made it harder to do my job and impacted my health. I hope this case leads to meaningful changes that support city employees and strengthen the services our community depends on. Since Joseph's firing, Gregory Jenkins II has taken over as interim director of SWS. He previously served as an assistant director in a different city department. In June, SWS employee Charlene Parker spoke during the City Council's public comment session about serious safety and management issues in his department. He said truck drivers are being told to work in unsafe conditions with faulty vehicles, and department leaders are treating their workers as, quote, disposable. Earlier this summer, Indy spoke to four more SWS employees who said their supervisors are exposing them and the public to unnecessary risk by ignoring safety concerns. They said when they raise those complaints with their supervisors, they get assigned worse routes and older trucks and receive negative performance reviews. In response to these employees' complaints, Jenkins wrote in an email to Indy, quote, our main concern is that our workers are safe when they perform this important job and that they arrive home safely at the end of the day. Indy also sent the city manager's office detailed questions earlier this summer about the employees' complaints, the high rate of workplace first aid and injury claims in the department, and the condition of the SWS fleet. A city spokesperson did not directly respond to the questions, but noted that most SWS employees received 11% pay raises this year to bring them up to market rate. The spokesperson also said the city will complete a, quote, staffing survey next year to understand whether its departments are adequately staffed. Well, a slightly unusual, I don't know if we call it an op-ed or not, A College Sports Fan's Lament by Andrew Long. And this is probably too long for me to complete by the end of the program. I'll just read as far as I can. Kevin Trapani knows he shouldn't have picked up his phone on the morning of June 11th. He usually keeps it face down and silent to limit distraction during meetings. But when it buzzed and he saw the banner, he couldn't help but check it. The alert read, Chris Pollard named Virginia's basketball coach after 13 seasons at Duke. Excuse me, baseball coach. Trapani immediately texted his family. Actually insane, his son wrote back. One of the most incredible heists of all time. Trapani, a former CEO who now teaches business at Elon University, is a 1979 Duke graduate who has lived in the Triangle since 1997. He's attended all manner of Blue Devils sporting events in that time. Barely 2 days before getting the alert, he sat in the stands at Jack Coombs Field for that decisive third game of Duke baseball's first ever home NCAA Super Regional. The chance at a College World Series berth for the first time since 1961 was on the line. Trapani remembers feeling confused about why Duke's players lacked their usual juice as they lost 5-4 to underdog Murray State. He felt the same way during Duke's 19-9 blowout loss the day before, and his family did too. So when the alert arrived that Pollard, the man responsible for turning Duke baseball from an irrelevant ACC backmarker into a perennial NCAA tournament team, had jumped ship after failing to capitalize on the greatest opportunity in program history, Trapani was furious. He told the Assembly, where this article was first published, he quit. From my perspective, he quit on his team. He quit on his school. He took to Facebook that day to air his grievances, touching on everything from his anger at Pollard's disloyalty and how many of the team's best players followed him to Virginia, 7 decided to transfer, to how thousands of Duke fans who had just come out to cheer their team on weren't rewarded with reciprocal effort. His main gripe was simple. I really don't like college sports right now. He's not alone. Many fans across the country have become increasingly disillusioned by a perceived disregard for loyalty and tradition as college sports have become more professionalized and less regulated. In North Carolina, a college sports mecca with 19 schools that compete in Division I, that's the highest level, the phenomenon has hit hard. Pollard declined to comment for this article through a spokesperson, but two of his Duke players told the Assembly that Pollard did not accept the UVA job before Duke was eliminated from the tournament, and that Pollard, a Virginia native who grew up in the state, was open with them about why he took it. They said their coach competed hard that weekend, and they wish him well in Charlottesville. Even if the team felt Pollard was honest with them, that doesn't remove the shockwaves his departure sent through Duke, nor does it remove Trapani's feeling of betrayal. In that way, whether Pollard quit is not quite the issue. It's that Trapani believes that he did. It feels to me there are a few things that just need to be done to stop this kind of craziness from happening. It just makes it very unrewarding to be a fan of any kind. And the article goes along for another 3.5 pages, which I am not privileged to have the time to read. But I will just mention, as I often do, that the entire contents of IndieWeek.com is available online for free. And so if you head over there and engage, you'll find this and other weekly issues. Including their famous awards, Best in the Triangle issues, which goes on for reams and reams of paper, and other features. Lots of culture, and I had to forego reading about some film exhibits and photography that maybe I'll put back in my folder, hopefully be able to get to in future. For now, John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service will tell you that this podcast will become available after its initial broadcast Friday. And on behalf of the NC Reading Service, thanks everyone for listening to us. We'll be back next week. Goodbye.